And welcome to the Generations Radio program. Hey, my name is Dave Buhner. I'm filling in for Kevin Swanson today, normally a co-host. Today, I'm promoted to the big chair, the golden mic. Kevin Swanson is gone, and so sitting in for him is myself. And sitting in for myself is Steve Vaughn. Hey, Steve, welcome to the co-host chair.
Well, thank you. It seems like I'm actually in the bigger chair than you are, but I'll accept the co-host capabilities and the responsibilities of co-hosting.
Well, normally the co-host has to carry the content of the program anyway.
Oh, really? I thought it was the host. So I guess I'm wrong there.
Well, Steve Vaughn is a homeschool father, much like myself, except not like myself. He has more than five children. He has five daughters, though. He has five daughters and one son. Zach is his son. And how long have you been homeschooling?
From the very beginning. Our oldest daughter is 21 years old now. She's actually coming close to 22. We began with her in kindergarten when she was about 5 years old. And we've been doing it since then. So that's, what, 16 years?
15. 21 years. 21 minus 5. That's a quick math there.
Okay.
16 years. Yeah, I guess 16. 16 years. Now, 16 years ago, you made a decision, you and your wife made a decision, that with your oldest child, you were not going to send her to the public schools. What was your reasons? What was driving that?
We thought that we could educate her better at home. We at least held to the fact that there was creation and things like that, and we thought that it would be a lot more difficult to untrain her from the education that she would get and then retrain her at home and try to tell her that, okay, this is what you need to write on the test, but this is really what we believe, and yet you still need to respect your teachers because they're doing the best that they can. And so it was very academic-based. We realized that we could give her better academics at home, and it would be just simpler in the long run for us.
So part of it is academics and part of it is values. You don't want your values being undone in the government schools, and you want her to be able to excel academically as far as her mind and gifting would allow.
Right. And, we had the vision that she was very intelligent, and we could see that, and we wanted her to be able to go as far as she possibly could, and that we were going to train her to choose a career and to say, you know, look, you can do really whatever you want to do in this world. It's the American dream, and you can become whatever you want to become.
And what did she become?
Well, right now she's staying at home, and she is partly my office assistant, and she helps she's in charge of the menu of the family, and she is being trained to be a wife and a mother.
I think the answer to that question is, what did she become? She became a beautiful lady, my oldest daughter, perfectly fit for a proper young man to marry.
Absolutely.
That's what she became. Yeah.
And it's interesting that when after about 4 or 5 years, they had a question at one of the groups she was in, and they asked what she wanted to be when she grew up, and she was still fairly young, you know, four or five years into the homeschooling. And I said, so what did you say? And she said, I want to be a mother just like Mom. I want to stay home and be a wife and a mother. And I tried to counter that at the beginning. I said, you know, you could be whatever you want. You could be a doctor, a lawyer. You know, you're really smart. She said, no, I want to stay home. I want to be a mom and a wife.
I think God puts in our DNA, in our image bearingness, a desire in our young ladies to be the proper biblical role of a wife. There's some remnant, some echoes of that in the past. Also that men have something in their DNA to be dominion takers, to be providers and protectors. And when women usurp the role of men, they become providers and protectors, and men feel usurped in that role, they don't know what to do, and they wander aimlessly, and at least there's video games so they don't destroy society.
That's right, and we don't then have to grow up. We don't have to take on the responsibility. We can stay boys the rest of our lives, and you know, as long as somebody is taking over that responsibility, I think men have a tendency to say, well, that's being taken care of, and we can sort of check that off our list. But the problem is that if it's on our list, we're supposed to be doing that.
We are. And that's, I guess, where I want to take the program today. I want to go back to the law of God and the Word of God. And I want to talk about duties, responsibilities, and what the Bible teaches. Because I think many of us entered homeschooling, Christian homeschooling even, for all the wrong reasons. We didn't know why we should be doing it. We just had some fuzzy little sense that maybe this could be a better way. And we had, you know, 15, 16 years ago, a vision of the public schools is somehow or other not getting the job done, let alone whether or not they should be doing it. They just simply weren't doing it. And so we decided that maybe we had to take something back from the public schools. And, of course, it was a hardship because they didn't give you a refund on your property tax. They didn't say, well, thank you for taking the kids out of our schools and here, have your money back. You had to do double duty. You had to pay for your homeschooling materials. You had to, in many cases, keep mom home who might have otherwise been in a job. That's a financial sacrifice if she was working. And you still had to pay your taxes, and you still had to support the school bus going up and down the road and everything else. So you really had to do double duty, and it was a bit of a sacrifice to do it. But for some reason or other, we thought we should.
Yeah, and I think it was, for us, it was still, it was just that. It was academics. We could do our academics better, and we also could do our values rather than trying to counteract the government's values. But that was really the limit of what our reasons were for homeschooling. And, you know, my goal, I look back 16 years ago and even, you know, 13, 14 years ago. And my goal was that if our kids ended up smarter than the rest of the kids, if my kids knew the Bible better than their Sunday school teachers, if they knew all that, if they ended up not on drugs or alcohol, if they ended up not pregnant, then I'd done my job better than most people. And so that was sort of my goal. I wanted to be better than most, not necessarily the best, but better than most. And then I would consider myself a successful father.
Well, I want to draw our attention this morning, if you're listening to it in the morning, if you're listening to it in the evening, I want to draw your attention this evening into what the Bible makes is very central into the life of man, a very central institution. It was the first institution, is the family. The Bible is very, very concerned about families. It turns out three of the Ten Commandments are directed precisely at family. The fifth commandment, honor your father and mother. Don't commit adultery, which is the seventh commandment, and the ninth commandment, which deals with coveting other family stuff. In fact, the entire principle of private property is rooted in family. And the opponents know this. If we were to look at the communists, the socialists, the evolutionary thought, we would see some really important writings. Now, evolutionary thought concedes the centrality of the family, but they only concede it as a fact of history, something that's to be outgrown. It is the thesis in which individuality is the antithesis, and they believe with those two battle because of their education systems and their social programs that we'll get a new synthesis, which will result in the destruction of the family. But in order to do that, they also have to destroy private property, because property is very much rooted in the idea of family. For instance, inheritance. When you die, your stuff automatically becomes your wife's stuff. You don't have to fill out any paperwork. God says the two became one. The law recognizes that oneness. Your stuff belongs to your wife. Did you know that?
Yes.
She knows that.
Yes.
You know, some people joke, there's my stuff, her stuff. No, there's her stuff and our stuff, and I don't really have my stuff.
That's right.
You know, and that's kind of the way people think. The family is seen as the old collectivity. Now, there are some writers who talk about this old collectivity being rooted in a primitive society where it's dominated by a violent, primeval father who just inflicts his will upon all he can. He creates his own little fiefdom, and that's how they see family. And to the Marxist, that authority, that control is what needs to be opposed. Every much as the bourgeois authority needs to be opposed. Now, are you that kind of dad? Are you a domineering, you know, my way or the highway kind of dad?
I don't think so. I think it's God's way now. It's or the highway, and you know, I see my role as being the protector, the provider, the prophet, the priest of the family, and that is my role. But I need to love my wife as Christ loved the church and be willing to lay down my life for her. And not to exasperate my children, but to bring them up in the fear and admonition of the Lord. That's what my role is as a father. If I try to force that with an iron hand, then I think that can and has brought on rebellion.
Well, the church, plays a part in family and a part in property as well. Religion is seen as a projection of the family, and the family is to be destroyed. The religion might be destroyed. The private property might be destroyed. Private property is seen as the outgrowth of the family. The abolition of private property requires the destruction of the family as a prerequisite. I'm not saying this. Gerhardus van der Leeuw is saying this, who is a philosopher that contributes to communist thought. In fact, what he says is very important here. Since the essential nature of property is to be found in social relations rather than any inherent attribute of the thing or the object that we call property. Property, in other words, is not a thing but a network of social relations that governs the conduct of people with respect to the use and the disposition of a thing. Now, go through all that academic speak, you know, what is the thing? Well, the thing is the property, and he tries to define it away. But what he's saying is that the idea of property rights is rooted in social institutions, and that social institution is, in fact, the family. Among the peoples still furthering, property also plays a part as the common element of the family. For property is not just the object which the owner possesses, it is a power, indeed a common power. We find the common element of the family bound up with the blood and with the property. It is not confined to these, for it is sacred and therefore cannot be derived without any remainder from the given. Again, what van der Leeuw is saying is that the idea of property is rooted in the idea of family. Your children call your house their house. Right. When Zach comes, leaves his friends, he's leaving the hockey rink, he's going to go to his home. And yet he's, I'm guessing he's probably not listed on the deed.
No, he's not at all.
He's not on the deed. And yet he calls it his house. Now, why does he call it his house?
Because it's part of the family's house. It is our house. It is the family home.
Yeah, because it's part of also his inheritance. It's part of his claim as being part of the family. What's a family? You know, a family is, we'd like to define it biologically, but the Bible actually defines it a little differently. The Bible, when you look through the case law of the Bible, you see that a father disinherits his son when his son is a bad person. The Bible doesn't have this turn a blind eye to your children's crimes and sins because they're your children. They say, no, rather, if that child will not be corrected and you've tried to discipline him, take him to the elders. And if the elders say, you know, look, this guy, he's uncontrollable, they're going to stone him. You know, so the son is disinherited. That's why the fifth commandment says that the children will honor their parents. But in return, parents are to train up the child. And this is the relationship of family. A father is to teach his child the nurture and admonition of the Lord and not provoke him to wrath. Now, you can read that the child gets angry. I think it reads just as equally true that you're bringing wrath upon the child. God's wrath, the stoning of the elders in the city. What happens if you don't discipline a child? You know what happens if you don't discipline a child?
Oh, yeah. We've had friends that used to be friends that did not discipline their children. And, you know, back when Ashley was quite young and when their children were beating up on my Ashley, they ceased to become our friends because they didn't believe in disciplining. They believed in counting and timeouts. And that just did not work.
So a father is to make sure that a child is trained in the law of God. That's clear throughout the Old Testament, many, many references. I won't repeat them all, or any of them for that matter. Instead, I want to go to the words of Jesus, because some people say, well, that's Old Testament. You know, we don't stone people in the New Testament. Well, I'm thinking maybe we ought to from time to time. But Jesus in Matthew 5 makes this statement in verse 19. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So here we have a general principle that the least of the commandments are important to Christ, to Jesus. They're important. And when you're teaching, and the primary group that you're going to teach is your own children. If you were to teach them to break even the least of the commandments, you won't lose your salvation. You won't lose your election. That's not for you to determine anyway. But you will lose status in the kingdom. You'll become least in the kingdom. Now, what is the least commandment? What do you think maybe the least commandment is? Is it Sabbath keeping? Is it modesty? Trimming the edges of your beard? Not taking the Lord's name in vain? I mean, pick one that you want to be the least.
Wow, that's tough because you know, when Jesus spoke about the law and they asked which is the greatest commandment, his first answer was basically the first four, and the second commandment was the last six. I mean, the second one is like it, that you love your neighbor as yourself. And so how do you choose one of those to be the least? I can't.
So here's the next question. Which of the commandments do they teach in the government school?
Actually, they sanction none of those. In fact, the government, I think, has sanctioned the breaking of every single one of those, and they are teaching how to break them.
Including not to steal?
Yeah. I mean, you're taught to envy what everybody else has. I mean, you're taught
the ninth commandment.
Yeah. You're taught to envy what the rich has, and that if you play your cards right, the government will take it from the rich and give it to you.
Okay.
You're taught to dishonor your parents, because if your parents discipline you, you can call social services and they can come in and discipline your parents for disciplining you.
So we have a principle in play here. And you're in charge of raising your children and nurturing the admonition of the Lord. If you delegate that to the public schools, are you, by that delegation, teaching your children to disobey the least of these commandments?
You're teaching them to disobey every single one of them, not just the least of them.
And I say you're breaking also the fifth commandment directly, because part of that contract that your children are to honor you is that you are to honor them by teaching the law of God to them, and you're not doing it.
Right.
But Jesus goes further. In Mark chapter 9, he says, whoever causes one of these little ones, you know, a little one would be a child.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you know, we know what a little one is. A little one's a child. Whatever cause one of the little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea. Now, what does he mean stumble? Well, he means stumble in the law of God. It doesn't mean that you trip him, that you push him over a rock from time to time. I mean, that would be childish, but that would hardly be worth getting a millstone tied around your neck. What gets you the millstone treatment? Stumbling your little child. Now, can you stumble a little one, a child, let's say a seven-year-old, by sending him to a place where the law of God is taught to be broken?
Absolutely. That's more than putting the stumbling block in front of them. I think it's putting it in front of them and pushing them over it so that they will stumble. I mean, I think that's totally abdicating your responsibility. You're causing a stumbling, and it's more than just putting the stumbling block there. You are then turning off the lights and telling them to walk forward.
And so what we get is from the words of Jesus, that the law of God is to be taught to our children. And it's to be honored and practiced. And failure to do so can make you least in the kingdom. And if you stumble them, that is, I mean, you really don't do it, you would be better if a millstone were tied around your neck and you were thrown to the bottom of the sea. In other words, that you were drowned. It would be better if your life were snuffed out than you offend one of Jesus' little children. He's pretty careful and picky about his children. Now, I think that brings us round to what we can say is the home education principle, that parents need to see, at least be responsible, that their children are raised in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. That's their duty. We love to talk about Deuteronomy 6. Fathers, teach your children as they rise up, as they lie down, as they walk along the road. What are we to teach them, Steve? What are we to teach them?
To love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength. And, you know, that hero Israel, the Lord is one. That's what you teach them. You're teaching them about who God is and how to love God. So as you're going along the way and you see something, you relate that back to how does that relate to God. When you're doing even academics, it's, you know, math. God created math. God created science. He is the master of them all. And so you relate everything back. History, everything can go and needs to go back to the law of God, because he's the one who's in charge.
Now, this is the connection I want to make here. When we teach our children the law of God, we're giving them something. We're giving them spiritual capital. We're teaching them how to live their life. If we're practicing the law of God, we're also giving an inheritance. And they have a double duty, right? They're to honor us by obeying us when they're small, and then they're to honor us when they're big by taking care of us when we're old and feeble and can't work anymore. not through Social Security, but through actually a family enterprise. So, you know, we call them houses and things like that, or common property. So the solidarity of the family is very much rooted in this capital. You give your children the inheritance, which is seed money. I wouldn't call it that, seed money, to start their business or continue your business. And then they take care of you. The communist system, the system that is being tried to be implemented, it's in the process of being implemented in this country, being advocated by higher education largely, wants to abolish both private property and the family. The two are linked. You can't have one without the other. That's what people need to understand, is that if you get rid of family, you get rid of private property. What happens in the communist system when you die to your property?
Goes to the government. Goes to the state.
Right. The government becomes your heir.
Right.
So the government is your child in that sense. But here's the weird thing. The government also wants to be your parent. Who educates you?
The government.
So the government is your parent, and the government is your child. What does that do to your parent?
It makes them obsolete.
Obsolete. So, you know, drop them off the daycare and be done with them. And what does that make your child?
It makes them a ward of the state, and it makes them no longer yours, and it absolves you of all your responsibility. You're free. Right?
You're free. You're free to go buy your RV and spend their inheritance, I suppose. Well, that's the other system. The biblical system has the solidarity of the family inheritance. It's tied up, absolutely tied up, in the home as a center of training. Now, in the biblical system, not only were you required to teach your child the law of God, and that's like lesson one. That's, you start that right away, right? You don't hit your sister. That's an application of the law of God. And then you teach them the Ten Commandments, and you start teaching them case law, and you start teaching them theological constructs. But you also have to teach your, especially your sons, a trade. In the Hebraic system, if you did not teach your son a trade, it was the same as disowning them. The same as saying, you're not my son. Go away.
That's amazing, isn't it, that would be that precise, that harsh of a judgment against you for not teaching them a trade, is that you are essentially saying, you are not my son.
And why give him property? I mean, what's he going to do with it? He's going to waste it on a good time, and he's going to be prodigal. If you teach him the trade and you give him an inheritance, you're funding his further venture, economic venture, or household venture, because economics are rooted in the house in the biblical system. There were no corporations in the Old and New Testament. Did you know that?
Yes, there were families and families.
Did you know there
businesses.
Wasn't even partnerships?
I did not know that.
No, there was no family partnerships. Each family was their own business. In fact, biblical law made it such that even if you gave your property, you could lease it away, that it had to be returned on the year of Jubilee. Right? So even property had to stay in the family. You couldn't deed it away. If you married, if your son married somebody from another tribe, if he was from the tribe of Dan and he married someone from the tribe of Naphtali, that property stayed in the family of Dan. It could not be transferred over, even if he had no heirs. She was essentially adopted into the new tribe, such that the properties could not be coalesced by one tribe or another. They couldn't centralize. It had to be distributed and had to stay within the family. Great principle. Great principle. Think about it. If you bought land and you owned it, and or it was given to you by God in the Old Testament sense, your kids couldn't mess that up for their great-grandkids. No matter how prodigal a life they lived, that property returned back to your great-grandchildren or your great-great-grandchildren.
Yeah, that's because really everything belonged to God anyway. He's, you know, we are not given in that sense any of the property. It is we're stewards of that property because it does belong to God. All of it does. The world is the Lord's. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And therefore, he is leasing it to us in essence. And therefore, when he says it goes back. And that also brings it, you know, up the idea of the double portion, whereas the oldest son got twice as much as everybody else, because he was then responsible for taking care of the rest of the family, his sisters, his younger brother, his mom, and his dad. He took that over with the double portion.
He got the double portion if he did the work of the first heir.
Right. If he was the firstborn.
If he didn't do the work of the first heir, that could be passed on to a younger child who would actually take care of mom and dad. So taking care of mom and dad was rewarded. So it was encouraged.
Yes.
We didn't have a social security system. We had, you know, families.
And we didn't have nursing homes that you could just go store your parents away, that you can go see them once a month or whenever and run off and play.
So families had the function of education, training. They had the function of an economic unit. They also had the function of charity. They didn't have charitable organizations. You had families. So people, for instance, could glean the edge of your field. You're told not to take everything out. Don't do the third cutting of your hay or of your picking your olives or whatever. Leave it so that the poor could go out and work. And as they work, they would be able to get themselves a share of something to eat and they would be able to survive. That was done at the local level. It was not enforced by the magistrate. They didn't have the United Way with football players asking people for money. They didn't have Boy Scouts out in front of King Supers trying to sell you popcorn or Girl Scouts trying to sell you cookies. Rather, you had families taking care of people usually they had relationships with because they lived in the area. They knew them. They went to the same synagogue or something.
Right. And then if all of that was failing, you had the kinsman redeemer, the law of the goel, where your nearest relative then would get you out of debt. So if you didn't have a direct brother or your parents, then you went to the nearest relative who would redeem you. And, that was a fascinating system. I think we need to get back to things like that. But the problem is that the government has taken over so much. Most people don't realize that you cannot, in the United States, actually own property, because even once you pay off the mortgage, you still pay rent to the government in the form of taxes. And if you don't think that that's rent money, try not paying your taxes. They come and take it away from you. So the property goes back to the government.
Well, the Marxist likes to make his hay with women. The women's movement, so-called women's movement, I'd call it the ugly women's movement, because whether or not they're pretty or not, they definitely act ugly. The women's movement, it seeks to tell them this story that they can be emancipated from patriarchy. Patriarchy is a very, very bad word. I don't know if you knew that. Patriarchy means domineering males. I asked you if you were one. I hope you are a patriarch. The Marxist system wants to emancipate a woman by making her an individual worker. Now first off, if people would read Marx, they would roll over laughing. They're going to free her to work in the factory because that's so much better than working in the home.
That's right.
Because the factory bosses, they're going to be much nicer than your husband. Now, in the biblical system, when a wife is met and betrothed, there is a process that takes place. And in this betrothal process, it involves an economic element called the dowry.
Yes.
In the dowry, in the biblical, especially in the Old Testament system, it was usually provided by the groom's family. Now, people say it sounds like they're buying a bride. Yes, they are, if you want to think of it that way. Now, it was often matched by the groom, where he had to provide it himself if his family couldn't. And that gave the groom's family then the vote to scuttle the marriage. You say, she's not the one for you, son. That offends our individualistic sensibilities. It was often matched by the bride's family in order to send them off. In fact, in America, we had a tradition, a great tradition, by the way, that the bride's family would provide a milk cow, usually a young milk cow, to the bride as their wedding present. That was they could add to it, but that was the standard wedding present. Not a toaster, a milk cow, because then they could start their herd. They had a female that they could start their herd with. Bulls are easy to find. Milk cows, that was the goal there. That dowry provided security to the wife and to the child. That wasn't just given to the bride's father so that he could go out and get a big screen TV or a two-hump camel with air conditioning. It was there held in trust for the bride. If something happened to her husband, it was his life insurance policy. If he turned out to have committed adultery and been proven, he would lose that dowry.
And his life.
And his life. And she would be provided for. She would have some money. It was usually about 3 years' wages. In Europe, they reversed it. During the Middle Ages, the woman had to provide a dowry to the man.
Wow.
In other words, she had to say, I'm so bad. Will you take me if I pay you? And that made women sort of a liability. Men would hate it on that birthday if they had another daughter. In your case, I mean, you'd be saying, I got five daughters. How am I going to be able to afford this? I can't take care of them all their lives, and I can't afford to get them married because I can't afford five dowries. You may be thinking I can't afford five weddings.
Yeah.
Fortunately, in the family economic circles, the weddings can be less than $100,000.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Less than $50,000 each. And besides, I think you can get some grant money from the government. It's a shovel-ready job.
Yes.
That custom then also gave the bride's family a say-so over the groom. You recall that when Jacob's servant goes and gets Rebecca, that even Laban has a say-so in whether or not this marriage will take place. In other words, it's not just individuals getting together. It's whole families. It's whole family enterprises. The economics, the family, the education system, it's all tied in this one organic little thing that God created, this institution called family.
Yeah, and that, you know, that's one of the things that you really can't necessarily escape now is when you marry someone, you do marry the family, and you find that out whether you like it or not. But, you know, the whole concept of the dowry is fascinating. And they could deposit the money, and they could use the interest back then, but they could not ever spend that dowry money directly because that had to be kept held in trust just in case if something would happen. That's a great system. I think we need to get back to that.
Okay, well, we see that the family then involves training sons, it involves training daughters, it involves economics, it involves teaching things. The last point I want to make is that the fifth commandment, honor your father and mother, that may go well with you in the land, you might live long, brings an economic blessing here and now for keeping of the law. And it brings economic curses for breaking of the law. And this is one of the most important overlooked points in education. That is, success is rooted in our historical roots. You are carrying on your family name. You're carrying on your family lands. You're carrying on your family businesses. If a son is a vile person, it reflects bad on his mother and father. He's not just cursed himself. He's cursed his parents who were to discipline him, who were to teach him the law. And if he refused the discipline to take him to the village elders, that the evil might be removed from the land. It was more evil. It was more hideous for a bad, wicked son, let's say a career criminal, to continue to live than it was for a father to say, my son is undisciplinable. We need to remove him from this world. As hard as that was, having a criminal son was a worse problem. And by the way, daughters too. There's many verses about not letting your daughters become prostitutes or loose women. Whorish activity depends on the translation you have. But they were a curse to the land as well. That was not how our daughters were to act. They were to become, in the New Testament, what Peter calls meek, which means others-centered. They think of others first, and a quiet spirit, which means not that they don't talk. It means that their spirit is still. They're content. They're not worrisome. They're not fretting. Rather, they're pleased with their husbands. They're pleased with their children. They're pleased with their lot in life. They're not wondering, why can't I break through the glass ceiling and become CEO of General Motors, even though I just have this associate's degree?
Well, it sounds to me like God is pretty serious about his law, and that we should be teaching our children God's law. And a lot of this, it's not being taught in the churches, let alone the schools, because the churches with their youth programs and, you know, bring all your unsaved friends and let's, you know, drink milk until you puke in the parking lot and things like that, that just does not cut it. We need to be very serious about what God says and be training our children, and not just in academics, but it's discipleship. One of the things that I came to understand was that our children will be discipled. That's not a question of if they will be discipled. The question is by whom and to what end. Our children will be discipled. They will be trained either by us or by someone else. And that someone else usually is the world or the government. And neither of those two ends is anything to be looking forward to. We need to be discipling our children, teaching them the law, training them in the way that they should go.
Well, in closing, let me say this, that the fifth commandment requires that children obey their parents when they're small. It commands when they're older to honor their parents. In exchange, the parents are to teach their children the law of God. When we honor our parents, we honor our inheritance at every level. You know, God gives us your parents. You don't get to choose them. You don't get to go down to the parent store and pick the newest model. You get the one that God gave you. And when you honor your parents, you honor God. When you curse your father or mother, that is equated to blasphemy. It's the same punishment. It is death. The death for blaspheming God. Death for blaspheming God, forgiving your mother and your father. You disinherit yourself from the blessings that God would have given you when you curse your mother and father. Now, maybe their only blessings were life and a few lessons. Apparently, you didn't lose those very well. What we get in a biblical system is in contrast. It's almost hard to imagine because we don't live in a biblical system. It's a system where a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. He's very interested in connecting himself to three generations. A lot of solidarity there. A good man leaves that inheritance because he wants to see his grandchildren start up their economic industry. He wants to see them continue economically. He doesn't want to just give them a college education. He wants to give him an inheritance, and the word for inheritance in Hebrew is a blessing. He wants to bless his children, even as Esau sought out a blessing with tears, but he could not find it because he wouldn't repent. The blessing goes to children who repent. We are to provide for our children. They provide back in return. We don't need, think of all the layers of government that could go away in a biblical system. We don't need Medicare, Medicaid. We don't need Social Security. We don't need any of the money distribution programs, including food stamps, because we'd have a biblical charity system operating. What would we need? We would need elders. And we would need parents who educate their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord.
Right. And then the government would do what they needed to do, which was to wield the sword and punish criminals who would seek to take those things away from us.
You know, Steve, it probably sounds to many out there like I'm talking a foreign language. Look, our goals for our children are simple. We want to see them saved. We want to take them to heaven with us. We want to see them sanctified, which means we're going to have to teach them the law of God. We want them to live a holy life, a productive life. We want to teach them how to worship and how to worship God in all their areas of study. When they open their chemistry book, they worship God for molecules and atoms, and they worship God in the physics, and they worship God in the math and the history and the art and the literature. We want them to be able to take dominion. We want to teach them how to do accounting or engineering or whatever that area of dominion is. We want to teach them that trade that they might be able to provide for their grandchildren. So it's partly investing in the inheritance. And we want to teach them heavenly spiritual wisdom. James 3 says, the wisdom that does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic. Two types of wisdom James lists. Wisdom from above, and wisdom that is earthly, sensual, and demonic. Now, I suggest to you that the government schools are largely the latter category, especially the demonic. And he goes on to say, for wherever envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now, to the parents out there, why are you homeschooling? Well, you're homeschooling because there are two types of wisdom. There's one that is pure. There's one that is not so pure. There's one that leads to salvation. There's one that leads to damnation. There's one that is a light unto their path. One that shows them where they can have the sure footing, and one that leads to death. And really, that's the system. The Bible really gives us two systems. One that leads to economic renewal, family solidarity, and generational blessing. And the other that leads to a bumper sticker that says, I'm spending my grandkids' inheritance. Well, folks, that's it. You know, you got two worlds. We have to swim in this one, but which one are we working for? When we pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, do we actually understand what it is we're saying? Do we understand that it's the law of God that operates in God's kingdom? It is his vision for society. He's given it to us in his word. Well, I'd like to recommend to you that you spend a little bit more time reading God's word, reading God's law, understanding it. I would highly, highly recommend to you R.J. Rushton's Institute of Biblical Law, a way to get into the law of God and see it afresh, see it in ways that you probably haven't thought of before. Take advantage of our history, of the wise men who have gone before, who've thought these things out, and continue to help think about it. Well, Steve Vaughn, thanks for joining us on this edition of Generations. My name is Dave Buhner. They want you to join us again next time as we cast a vision for the next generation. I have always felt that doubt was the beginning of wisdom, and the fear of God was the end of wisdom.
Clarence Darrow.
The only true wisdom is knowing that you know nothing.
Socrates.
Belief is the death of intelligence.
Robert Anton Wilson.
If thou trustest to the book called the Scriptures, thou trustest to the rotten staff of fables and falsehood.
Thomas Paine.
Faith is believing what you know ain't so.
Mark Twain.
Whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool, but he who walks in wisdom will be delivered.
God.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is insight.
God.
The fool believes his own ideas to be wisdom, but those who fear God and search for understanding find true wisdom. To lead your family in the pursuit of godliness, pick up a copy of the Proverbs Study Guide at generationswithvision.com.